Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Everyday Anarchism. I'm your host, Graham Culbertson, and my guest today is Alexander Horvat. That was close enough, right?
Yes, it was.
And I'm here talking with Alexander about this, this astonishing film, Henry Fonda for President. I'm already speechless. I love this film so much, Alexander. Can you, I guess I'm just going to ask you, and I'm sure I can jump in, to just introduce the film a bit to the audience so they know what we're talking about.
Well, first of all, thank you for your enthusiasm. I'm really happy that you liked it so much. This is my first film, and I'm 60 now, so it's a bit of an unusual debut. I let myself be seduced into this project by a producer in Berlin, and step by step, I came to grips with the fact that I now have a late new career, in quotation marks. And I told her, she was asking me if I was interested in making film historical things for television, and I told her, well, I'm not so much into this typical format, 52 minutes and so on. And at the end of this conversation, I said, I think the only subject that you could interest me in would be Henry Fonda and America, because I had, in my closing season as the director of the Austrian Film Museum, I had programmed, among other things, I had programmed a season on Fonda. And I had researched him again after a long while, not engaging with his life and his work. And I realized that for me, there is no other actor in whose both life and screen lives, in whose, let's say, imaginary existence on screen, as well as in his actual existence and that of his forefathers, his family, who came to America from the Netherlands in 1651, that in these lives of Fonda, there is so much, crossover, or so much points that lead to and reflect on and allow to reflect on aspects of American history and of this nation. And both subjects, Fonda and America, have been dear to me, or have been very interesting to me for my whole life, I guess. So I said that could be a subject where I imagined there would be not 20 other filmmakers also traveling in that area. So I thought it's something personal. So it became an essay film. It's a documentary, but it's more specifically an essay, a personal essay about these two things. And I often describe it as a double helix, that the Fonda line and the story of America circle each other, and sometimes they meet and sometimes they drift off again. So it's a epic film, I guess. It's 3 hours, even though people tell me regularly that it flows by and very swiftly. So I'm happy that people experience it as a very joyful and tight thing. So it's how should I say? I guess we will go into more detail, but it has one through line, which is really a chronology after a prologue, which explains a bit the personal approach. Why do I focus on this double helix? Why is Fonda interesting to me? What might Fonda mean to me or to everyone? After this prologue, it starts in the year 1651, and it goes straight up to the end of Fonda's life. He died in 1982, which is also the beginning of the Reagan presidency. So in that sense, the narrative of the film ends with that. But while a lot of the film consists of archival materials, both elements from Fonda's films as well as other media elements, television, talk shows, advertising, paintings from the 17th and the 19th and the 20th century, photographs. While there is this strong archival focus, there is also more than a third of the film which we shot in the US in 2019 and 2021, which is the present day America. So that's sort of the, I was hoping, and the idea was to create this kind of echo space between the end of the narrative, 1982, and the present in the US, without speaking about directly or naming current events in the US, or my narration does not hit on aspects of the last 40 years of American society and politics. But I was hoping that, since everybody, you know, has a lot of info on that current, on those current themes and figures, that audiences would be able and willing to fill that 40 plus year span between the present day images of America and the story that ends in 1982. So that's one way of, a long way, I guess, of introducing the film. There are other ways as well, I guess.
No, that was wonderful. There's plenty to say in response to that, but I guess the first place to start is I thought the present day America looked pretty bad. I thought the dream factory landscape that Fonda lived in looked a lot better than you and your cinematographer came to the United States in whatever. It looked like there was some COVID era footage in the 2020s, and I didn't want to live in that America that I saw.
Well, I must say that we did not set out to make America look bad. Quite the opposite. Both you mentioned the cinematographer Michael Palm, who's also the editor and an old friend, and the third person on our crew, Regina Schlagnitweit, my partner in life and in work. The three of us in a very intimate way made this film, and both trips we made and where we shot in the States were done just the three of us, and we actually like being in America, and we did not set out to make it look bad. What did happen, of course, is that the choice of locations and places which relate either to Fonda's life or to his forefathers and mothers, like the village of Fonda in upstate New York, which was founded by his great-great-great-great-grandfather. And there are places that relate to the films and to like Fort Apache or Tombstone, relating to My Darling Clementine. And there are places relating to his career, like his early years as a not yet successful actor on Broadway. He came to New York, and it took him several years before he was discovered, so to speak, or before he had a real success as a leading man. So shooting in Times Square at night in New York related to that moment in Fonda's biography. And we hear him speak about those years where he lived on salt and rice and had no major roles. And the fact, for instance, that on Times Square, where we shot in September 2021, among all those performers and the people who hope to be discovered or hope to they make their little, you know, artistic things, or they dress up as Mickey Mouse or as the Statue of Liberty and all these kinds of small-time performers that I always loved and was interested in, among those suddenly a Trump imitator pops up and enters our space and acts directly to Michael's camera with the typical Trump gestures, etc. And this was of course not planned. So this was an intrusion of present day political reality in some way, but again, as a performance, a man in a mask. And we followed him, and Michael went with this guy up and down Broadway for 40 minutes. And we discussed for a long time, the three of us, if we should include this footage in that New York Times Square passage, because we actually had thought we would never mention the name, and we don't mention the name. It's just we show this media figure, which he is, this strange creature of popular culture who is now for the second time president of the United States. When we included it, this was not yet clear. That's another thing. It's important that now the film is out in the US and has been released in Germany and Austria at the beginning of the year. This all happened in the direct context of the inauguration and the first months of the Trump presidency number two, when we finished the film in the summer and fall of 2023, and when it premiered at the Berlin Film Festival in February 24. Of course, things like these were in discussion, and the Trump and Biden eras were behind us or were in the middle of that. But the discussions about the film were not as directly geared towards what does it mean in relation to America, to the US today. But so it's different now. So the film is obviously in communication with what goes on in the US. But back to your question, what we did look for was a certain hauntedness of these spaces. That's what I actually wanted to say at first. The choice of places came from Fonda's life and roles. But in filming them, or in the way we decided to record them, it was not always the same, but some of these places, like the Craig House, which is a sanatorium, and which in Beacon, New York, and I just visited it now, 4 years later, and it's now a building site. It's going to be turned into a spa, but it was a sanatorium for psychiatrically psychic illnesses, and prominent celebrities were there, and Henry Fonda's second wife, Frances, spent a lot of time there and committed suicide in that place in 1950. So that was one of the locations we shot out of this personal family relation to Fonda. And of course, that's already a haunted place. The what we were looking for, very naturally, I guess, is the certain presence of the past. So if you have that in your mind when filming, and if you also have in mind how history is being reenacted in various ways on these and other places all the time, the way the United States do refer to their history constantly on street markers, historic markers on road signs, places where people in costumes reenact a certain era, outdoor museums. There's a lot of such places, and that was one theme that I was interested in. So with those themes in mind, I guess we ended up in portraying these places not in a very happy-go-lucky manner, but I would rather say, for me, it's melancholy. That's the main, I think, Stimmung or sensation I get when I review the footage now. And that was what we were going for, more or less, in different ways on these different places. I would personally not say that the US, America looks bad in these images, but maybe because I have grown used to, you know, my partner and I, Regina and I, have been traveling the States for more than 30 years in various places, and we like actually being in the so-called flyover states. We like being in the Midwest. We like traveling places where European tourists do not go that often, and where our New York or Los Angeles friends ask us what on earth makes you interested in going to Omaha or to, I don't know, whatever, Pennsylvania or Iowa or
North Carolina.
We've never been in North Carolina yet. Hope that will happen in the future. But so I guess our acquaintance with those sides of America that are not the triumphant, glorious king of the world kind of image that some parts of American society like to think of themselves that way. I have, for a long time, I have grown used to the fact that this is, of course, a lie, as it is always, as it is also in my country. The way Austria and Austrian society likes to portray itself often is far from actual reality. So this is not new to me. So filming those places and not making it appear a a glorious encounter is feels normal to me, and not as an attempt to shade the image of the country in a certain way.
Yeah, I think the hauntedness, you absolutely captured the hauntedness. I have follow-up questions about that, but now I'm going to swerve and say I did think watching this film, I mean, I was so essay cinema, especially documentary essay cinema, is one of the great passions of my life. It's a thread I haven't followed as much in the podcast. I guess here's something I meant to do all along. So if you're listening to this podcast and you don't know why I'm talking to this director about, you know, a film about the Hollywood actor, I mean, first I would think everyone gets it. Anarchism for this podcast for me is very broadly leftist, anti-capitalist, anti-hierarchical, everything to the left that is not Stalinist, you know. So of course, Fonda fits broadly in this sense. He was no anarchist, but he was a man of the left, without a doubt, as long as you define the left broadly. But to me, essay film is it's an anti-hierarchical way of filmmaking. It doesn't speak with the voice of God. It makes no claims that it has this sort of absolute truth. And the director, I was certainly thinking of Chris Marker while I was watching this, probably the most acclaimed essay cinema filmmaker of all time. Varda is my personal favorite, but I was thinking of Wenders. I was thinking of both Paris, Texas, mm-hmm. and then the film that I can't call it to mind right now, but the Ozu film, Tokyo Ga. So indulge me. Have you seen and were you thinking of these films?
I have seen most of Wenders' films, and I'm not specifically a fan of Tokyo Ga, I guess. I remember it having been bothered by certain claims he makes about Ozu, I think, but it's almost 40 years ago, so I should not speak about it. What your comment? I mean, two things that come to mind is one, that the essay film tradition is very strong in Germany or in German language countries. So people like Wenders and Herzog has made documentary films that you might call essayistic because it's very personal sometimes.
But yeah, Encounters at the End of the World is the one that stands out to me as most essayistic. But anyways, yes, I'm sorry, I interrupted.
There is people with lesser known in the film world, like Harun Farocki, who is become a big name at the end of his life, and after his death in 2014, Harun Farocki has become a big shot in the art world. But his cinema mainly was essayistic cinema, and I was very much in admiration of both the man who I was friendly with and his films, or Hartmut Bitomsky, who for a while was the dean of the film school at CalArts, another German essay filmmaker, and both of them were pretty radical leftists when they were thrown out of the Berlin Film Academy in 1968-69. And Alexander Kluge. So a part of the new German cinema, and that's a part that's not spoken or written about so much, but a very essential part of what we call the new German cinema is actually that kind of personal documentary reflection, Godardian sometimes, as in Kluge's case. So there is this not only in France, but also in Germany. And Wenders fits into this from another perspective as well, which is the fact that I was fully aware of being a non-American. That's why there is no English version of my narration. You know, that film exists. It's mostly in English. It's Fonda's voice. It's all the media material is in English, but my voice and two other voices, those of Hannah Arendt and of Günther Anders, very briefly, are in German. So I wanted to make it obvious to the viewer that this film speaks from another place. This film speaks from Central European German language world, and from my upbringing in that world with a cultural history and an intellectual history that is different from an American's upbringing. And the same goes for Wenders, of course, or for Hartmut Bitomsky, who made a film called Highway 40 West across the US. And Wenders made films like Paris, Texas, as you mentioned, or Alice in the Cities, and was always a keen observer of America. He wrote about, you know, there is an early piece of his film critical piece about Easy Rider, where he's totally enraptured by encountering Easy Rider as a 24-year-old. Wenders was very young at the time. So his approach to America is, I think, different than mine, but it is part of the footsteps that, I guess, intentionally or not, our film follows. Also, the essay film tradition is present in many different nations. And if you take it, like you define anarchism in a broad sense in your podcast, I was happy to make a big project together with Jean-Pierre Gorin. Jean-Pierre Gorin is a San Diego-based Frenchman. He came to the U.S. in the late 70s. Before that, he worked with Jean-Luc Godard on several films. He's a teacher, a writer. He makes great films. He made great films of his own. And he knows a lot about essay filmmaking. And he made this huge retrospective for the Film Museum and the Biennale in 2007 called The Way of the Termite, which was a rich history of the essay film. And he had a very broad definition of that genre, or that kind of film. It includes not only Marker and Varda and Godard and Farocki and Pitomsky and so on. It also includes, for instance, the earliest film was D.W. Griffith's A Corner in Wheat. And the youngest was Apichatpong Verasethakul's first feature, Mysterious Object at Noon. So to work on that retrospective, to talk to him, to have him as a guest and become friends with him, gave me an even richer appreciation for this notion, for this, as you say, anti-hierarchical, trying to escape convention and rigidity in all possible ways. So it's not a coincidence that my own attempt at filmmaking lands pretty exactly in that form, you know. Also, it's the only one that I could have even attempted, you know. I'm not a professionally trained filmmaker, but I come from writing, I come from curatorial work. So those two lead you very naturally almost to this kind of cinema. But as I said, it's also a kind of cinema that belongs to me, to the absolute high points that of anything this art form has ever produced.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I'm just going to say again, I don't think you'll get tired of hearing it. This film fits beautifully in this tradition. It's a great example.
I'm truly happy to hear that.
No, you should be proud of what you've done. And I don't know. I'm thinking about, you know, I teach a film class regularly. It might be fun to teach this film as a class. And which, of course, if I get to be the professor, I get to put in the ones that you left out that you should have put in, like the Anthony Perkins Western. What is it called? The Tin Star. I was waiting for the Tin Star the whole way through. And then when it didn't show up, I was very offended. So
I hope that's a joke. I hope it wasn't an offense, because there would be 50 or 60 offenses of that kind.
Yes.
People have mentioned that Advice and Consent by Preminger, which is a very interesting film, only appears very briefly. I mean, some of these were conscious choices to not discuss. Others were included in the 5.5-hour rough cut we had and simply had to go because I felt I wanted a compact, even though it's still 3 hours, I wanted a way of leading the viewers through this story. So some, also, for instance, that would have been even more essayistic, this whole complex around Godard, Jane Fonda, and Henry Fonda, which is a rich triangle, because Godard, as a young critic, wrote about Fonda, The Wrong Man, talking about the beauty of Henry Fonda's face and so on. And then he uses him in Godard's late work. Fonda reappears often, Mr. Lincoln and The Wrong Man. So there would have been a 45-minute, or there could be a 45-minute separate film just on that triangle, because Jane Fonda and Godard work together, of course, with Gorin in Tout va bien, and then the two of them made this pretty, I don't know, critical and not very kind essay film called Letter to Jane, where they compare her and her father regularly. So that's a whole different topic that we decided not to include, like several other lines of inquiry that I had. You know, there was this mountain of material that I could have followed, and that it just, at the end, it's like a sculpture taking away elements so that the form stands as you want it to stand, but it could have a different, even wilder or even more digressive form too. So what you are saying, yes, I'm aware of which Fonda films and which Fonda aspects are missing or almost missing. I guess I have to live with that.
Yes. No, of course. No, I didn't actually take offense. I'm gonna try and, you know, kind of go back to the beginning where I should have started, but I enjoy the digressive essayistic aspect of this podcast as well. There's undoubtedly people listening to this right now who don't know who Henry Fonda is. I'm going to try and explain in a second, but first I'm going to tell a story. I'll do my autobiographical thing. When I think I was probably a junior in high school, I took a class called, I don't know, Government and Politics, something like that. And we watched a film that I found dreadfully boring, about some uninteresting man who was arrested for some uninteresting crime and didn't get a lawyer and was convicted because he couldn't afford a lawyer. And then he, you know, wrote the Supreme Court and got a lawyer. And the reason why poor people have lawyers now in America is because of this boring man in this boring film. And when I found out about your film, I just immediately threw myself into watching all the Henry Fonda movies that I'd always meant to watch and not watch. And so I was going through on IMDb or Wikipedia or something and was just shocked that that boring movie about the justice system, made for TV movie from 1980 or whatever, that I had watched in 2000, was a Henry Fonda film called Gideon's Trumpet. And when you're talking about haunting, it seems to me, first of all, when you say that this country is haunted, it strikes me that what we are haunted by, or one of the key things we are haunted by, is this period from roughly the election of FDR through roughly the election of Ronald Reagan. This is an oversimplification, but roughly true, when America was broadly solidaristic, broadly a social democracy, broadly built things. You know, the latter part of this, you have the anti-communist wars of imperialism, but at the beginning of this, you have the still, I believe, widely celebrated U.S. intervention in World War II. I believe we're still broadly happy about that as well. And I would not have thought this before. I don't know how if you'd asked me who the icon of that era was, I don't know. FDR, MLK, both of those would have come to mind. But having watched your film, you make a pretty good case that, in fact, the one single person in that 50-year period who stood for this broad America is better than it has to be, it's going to get better, it's going to help everyone, who draws together anti-lynching and trial by jury and Abraham Lincoln and John Steinbeck all into one figure. And somehow it's this mild-mannered, self-effacing Midwestern everyman who refuses to talk about himself and covers his face in this totally anti-triumphalist way, to the point that even I, as a schoolboy, or at least a school adolescent, was taught sort of, this is who we are. This is how we do things the right. If you want to teach a young American how to do things the right way, you, or at least you used to, back in the 20th century, you show them a Henry Fonda film. And I hadn't recognized that, Alex. And you showed it to me. You showed me what my country was haunted by. It was exquisite. It was exquisite. Okay, now that's not a question. That's just a statement.
No, but now my reaction is exquisite. It's not exquisite. It's just sheer happiness that a film that I did not include, and I had only watched Gideon Trumpet at the time. I guess I was 19, or I saw that in the early 80s on TV, I guess, that you had this a similar, even though unconscious, I guess, relation to an early Fonda experience. And what you developed out of that personal moment is exactly what was it, the specific intention and my realization that it's, of course, you could say coincidental. Fonda was alive and active in that exact period. He was a FDR liberal. He was a left liberal, but he was his political views, his conscience was certainly shaped not only by his liberal father, one of the few liberal families in what he called a reactionary hotbed, Omaha, in the early years of the 20th century. So he took a lot, I guess, from his father, but then from his 1930 years in the 1930s, and from identifying with Roosevelt's New Deal, etc. So this. And he dies in 82. So yes, that's exactly the period. And that's why I felt it makes sense today, after more than 40 years have passed, to look back at that period and wonder. It's not nostalgia. I hope that, sometimes a film like that might be accused of leftist nostalgia, not opening your eyes to the changed reality of America, et cetera, et cetera. I think I am aware of the American reality and of not only American, but many parts of Europe and elsewhere are under the threat of democracy turning into authoritarian systems. But I did want to indicate other ways of behaving as a society and as an individual in society and relating to the rule of law, etc., solidarity, all the things that you mentioned. So I believe that history, there is this Hegel expression, I think it's by Hegel, and I don't know if the translation is correct, but in German, the phrase is die Listen der Geschichte, and it means the ruses of history. I don't know if ruses would be the... History is not... There is no determinism in history. So it's as easy to say, oh, this will go on like it's going on now. Democracies will die everywhere, like they seemed to die in the 1930s, in the Roosevelt era. The Western world and Europe was in the throes of fascist and authoritarian regimes, Stalinism in the USSR, and major intellectual magazines, writers in America talked about, can democracy survive? There was also a threat from, or threat to democracy from communist parts of the spectrum. And we're in a similar situation, not so much the threat from communism, but the question, can democracy survive and will they survive? It's not decided. The ruses of history mean that history has a way, if history was an agent, which it is not, personalized agent, of course, but history has ways in which things happen and individuals appear and tendencies shift that you could not foresee. So my hope was always that also, when I work with students or with audiences as a curator, by showing films, by talking to people, you can indicate certain moments from the past that might be touch points for things that happen in the future. There is no determinism. And why not use this 50-year period of which you spoke as a potential? And as you said, it's a hauntedness. There is this... like Mark Fisher in his hauntology often, I think, refers to. I'm not an expert in Fisher theory, but we are haunted by not only the demonic pasts, but we're also haunted by the unfulfilled promises of certain pasts. And I guess that was, you could describe my approach to this whole project and to these themes as similar to that. And I'm happy that you, I'm really, really, truly happy that you have a similar experience, even though I believe you are younger than I am. But you have the arc at least is comparable, maybe.
Yeah, no, I think it is a comparable arc. But the other thing is, you know, I mean, I have a friend who I speak to about politics and anarchism all the time, who is older than me and is older than you, and was, you know, a member of the SDS in the 60s. But he still, you know, he likes Eisenhower because, you know, Eisenhower, would we have preferred Adlai Stevenson? Of course we would have. But when you compare Eisenhower to anyone after Carter, and I am including Obama, I always say Biden, you know, Biden was lost. He thought it was 1963 or 47 or something. So he didn't know you weren't supposed to just spend money on making people's lives better. So he was just sort of confused and befuddled. He thought American government could still work for the people, whereas Barack Obama was much smarter and knew that nothing but corporate partnerships and drones on random Muslims who may or may not have been just going to a wedding, that was how you did America. Anyway, so thinking back to these radicals who, you know, my friend Larry, who likes Eisenhower, of course, the person in my position, I'm 41 in the 50s, would have hated Eisenhower and probably hated Adlai Stevenson as well, and was wishing that Eugene Debs was still around, you know? So one of the things that strikes me, this is the leftist nostalgia bit. You read Fassbinder, and he just loathes the Bay Area. He just hates it. It is just the most capitalist, revolting, pro-American, imperialistic state he can imagine. And then you look at where we are in 2025, and you look at what the Bay Area was like when Fassbinder was excoriating it for its capitalist imperialism, and you're just like, it's Fassbinder,
the model of the social state, right?
Yes. So I'm struck by this. And then the way we make this part of your film is the rebellion in the 60s, in some ways, the people who led the rebellion were literally Fonda's children. I mean, there's a famous song, if you don't know it, it's called For What It's Worth. One of my favorite songs ever, a song that I remember first listening to on the radio when I was like 8. It's by a band called Buffalo Springfield. The lead singer is Stephen Stills on that song. The star is Neil Young. The star is always Neil Young. That's not up for debate on this podcast because of the guitar. And it's about a left-wing battle between hippies, countercultures. I'm sure there are plenty of people who call themselves anarchists, and you know, the forces of the status quo, and it's the people who made Easy Rider, including Henry's son Peter, who are there with Neil Young and Stephen Stills. So they were
may I intercept and ask if that song takes the side of the counterculture and of the news to 100%, or is it aware of the complication that if a countercultural new left generation opposes a Rooseveltian left father's generation, that something not awful, but something problematic could come out of that conflict?
I don't think when Stills is writing that song and Buffalo Springfield is recording it, that they see the potential for it to curdle. I don't think so. But that's what I'm asking you is how did it curdle?
You know, that's a good question. If you read what I did at one point in this long work on the project, I read Peter Fonda's, Jane Fonda's, and Henry Fonda's autobiographies in parallel. So you read certain events, like the suicide of the mother and wife, or Easy Rider. You read it from three different viewpoints. That was fascinating. And I can only recommend all three, actually. I mean, Peter's is the most flippant and the least literary, you could say, but highly interesting. Jane Fonda's is very smart, and it's one of the intellectually also, I must admit, most stimulating movie star biographies I've ever read. And Fonda, it's a autobiography as told to Howard Teichman. So it's like the Lawrence Grobel interview that we use in the film. Late in his life, he accepted his family's wish to leave something behind. So he did these two things, the long interview with Grobel for Playboy magazine and this book, quasi autobiography. So if you read these, it's funny to see how Peter Fonda shows his father a 4-hour rough cut of Easy Rider and how the father reacts. And not aggressively at all. He kind of, he has admiration for his son, and he spoke publicly about that, but it doesn't seem as if there were really it doesn't seem as if the conflict was really decisive or harsh. You know, there were harsh moments also when Jane Fonda separates from Roger Vadim and moves in back briefly for half a year with her father. That's in 69, I believe, 68, 69. And she lives with her father, and she brings home Black Panthers, Angela Davis. So she has all the people that she's an activist for. She supports those movements. And Henry Fonda is interested, to a degree at least, in meeting these people, but he feels quite distanced by, not so much, I think, by the actual positions they have, but by the rhetoric, by the tone, by the militancy, by the aggressiveness. So he cannot deal well with that generation of militants. Maybe he knew radical leftist militants in the 30s. Maybe he, because I'm including a non-Fonda film by Leo Hurwitz, Strange Victory. And I was thinking of the film and photo leagues of the 1930s, and I'm wondering if there was any contact between budding Broadway actor, yet still unknown Broadway actor Henry Fonda, and those leftist independent filmmakers who made newsreels against the March of Time and for the left. So maybe he was reminded of that. I don't know. But the tone in the 30s was certainly not the one that he experienced in 69 with Angela Davis. So how did it curdle, was your question. I don't know. You wouldn't see it if you read those memoirs by father and son and daughter. What I'm led to is comparing it also to the present. How did the, forgive me for using this overused term of woke culture of the last maybe 10, 15 years. But I now, as a 60-year-old, I have witnessed similar conflicts internally in the left, where people of my generation do not deal so easily, and vice versa with 25-year-olds and their views on where leftist politics should go. So maybe it's that's a similarity in some ways. You would know much better than I do how this plays out in the American campuses and in American universities, where I'm sure you have teaching personnel in their 50s and 60s and students in their 20s seemingly being interested in the same or in a certain shift in culture, but doing it in so different ways and talking about it in such different ways and using languages that often don't seem compatible to each other, that maybe there's a one reason. But in the right, it never, you know, the way Trump and the fundamentalists have been able to take over the Republican Party, there was no conflict. It seems to me, at least, there was no real conflict on the right, because in order to stay in power or to regain power, the Republican Party and the conservatives are willing to go anywhere. So they are even willing to go the Trump way. In the leftist context, it never seems so easy. You know, you have you have Kamala Harris supporters versus Bernie Sanders supporters, which, I mean, this is not a big fight, I guess, but still, it seems that this tendency to not know when to prioritize which topics is one of the issues that the left deals with regularly and has dealt with also in 68 and the years after 68. If I think of France and Germany, how the factionalism in the left led to a complete breakdown of what 67, 68, or what Guy Debord's thoughts seemed to have promised, you know, that ended badly. It's not this, that factionalism is not the same as Bernie Sanders or Kamala Harris, et cetera, but maybe the criticality that is an essential criterion for leftist thinkers and activists is also a problem when it comes to gaining in a short period of time, gaining cultural hegemony. So I don't know. That was not a very smart, good answer to your question where it curdled. The thing is that with the Fondas, it a few years after these conflicts, they were a very happy. They appeared publicly and as a family, they supported each other. They had projects together. There was a film project about the American Revolution where all three of them would have starred in, which never came to pass, at least on Golden Pond with Henry and Jane did happen. But they had hoped in the late 70s, they had hoped to make something together. That was the Carter years. And it seems that the Carter years, so underrated by I feel, maybe only in Europe by historians, as a quasi loser presidency. For me, it's the most progressive presidency the U.S. has had since Roosevelt, you know. So in those years, which is also the years that the film ends with and where Fonda was proposed in this TV sitcom Maud, was proposed as a candidate for president. In the end, in that year, 76, in the November of that year, Carter was elected. And those were the years when that didn't seem that the new left and the Roosevelt left were at loggerheads, or it seemed that something could come out of this where actually where the generations could, I have only the German word, versöhnen, could reconcile in a very productive manner. And then came Reagan and nothing came of that. Maybe that moment of hope that also what Johnson, you know, who is in some parts, he's remembered as the horrible guy who was responsible for the Vietnam War. In other factions, he's mostly remembered as the creator of the supporter of a great society all the things that in a very brief period of time he instituted, during his presidency or his yes. government is remembered, and not so much his part in the Vietnam War. Now imagine that after the Vietnam War ends and Carter becomes president, that those promises of the LBJ era concerning the social state would come to fruition and would expand. That it could have gone that way also, but the way the Vietnam War hacked, there is a kind of abyss or break, I think, in American self-consciousness. On the one hand, not really dealing with what the war meant. On the other hand, and that's Reagan creating a nostalgia for the time before, and like leaving it to the side. So that constellation, at least, which comes at the end of Fonda's life, leads to the 40 plus years that we have now experienced, and in which those promises of the Lyndon of Roosevelt or Adlai Stevenson or Lyndon B. Johnson or Carter have not remotely been fulfilled, you know?
Yeah, no, I think that's all right. And then again, to throw Biden in there, the Biden's presidency domestically is nowhere near as momentous as LBJ's, but similar in some ways. And then the, I still don't know what we are supposed to call it, but the conflict in Gaza is nowhere near as soul splitting to the American experience, but it has a similar effect of driving a wedge mm-hmm. between people. You know, your Robert McNamara's, who I would guess when it comes to Vietnam, we have Fonda on the other side of McNamara, but the, you can imagine Fonda and McNamara aligned on a lot of things, but not the Vietnam War. And in the same way, you can imagine a lot of people aligned with Biden, but not on the Gaza conflict. And that sort of seems to me in miniature. Also, I learned from your film that Henry Fonda took part in the dropping of the atomic weaponry on Japan, which, boy, that was okay. But I need to not bring that up now.
He didn't take part in a very top level, but he was there when his commandant instructed the pilot of the Enola Gay which targets to look for.
Yes, he was. He said that he and his commanding officer were the people who told the Enola Gay where to drop the bomb. And which, again, I have so much more to say about this film, but I'm going to hold myself. Which is to say, we've been talking for almost an hour. I think I blocked 90 minutes off. I could do this for an hour more, but we can also head towards the end. I mean, you tell me. Do you want to talk a bit longer? Are you ready to be done?
You decide. I'm happy to continue, but you know better than I do what the arc and the format of your podcast is.
So yes.
I'll try to give shorter answers. I know I have the tendency to digress and to speak for longer than I should, but
No, this is perfect. This is exactly what I wanted. And look, I mean, what can I say? I don't know how you felt making your film. I make this podcast to have the conversations I want to have, and I hope people listen. But it's pretty reliable that if I decide to make an episode that I think is like, I'm going to make a hit episode that lots of people are going to listen to, it doesn't do better. And then I make an episode and I think, oh, I don't know if anyone's going to listen to this. And those don't do worse. I can't predict. So I have the conversations I want to have. And let me tell you, I'm enjoying this conversation immensely. So now we need to talk about 12 Angry Men and Grapes of Wrath, but before we get there, in case we go off on this, I need to talk to you about Hank Fonda's right-wing doppelganger, because there is another actor who stands for America and democracy and institutions. There's another actor whose films are still shown to American school children about what it is to be American. And I didn't know this, but he was Fonda's roommate, best friend. So if you watch, and for those of you who are not obsessed with cinema, the actor's name is James Stewart, better known as Jimmy Stewart. When you watch his films in the 60s, they are all just absolute valorizations of the worst part of the American of this 30 glorious years. So the two that stand out to me is there, and they're both, what, like 3 hours long? One is just a nonstop litany of how great the FBI is. I think it's called The FBI Story. And then the SAC or Strategic Air Command, I mean, basically the airplanes whose job it is to always be ready at any moment to nuke. I mean, you can say nuke the Soviet Union if you want, but really I would say to end human civilization. So we get films like Mr. Smith Goes to Washington and things like that. Obviously, It's a Wonderful Life, films where Jimmy Stewart seems to stand for the good parts of America that we want to celebrate. And then in the 60s, when Fonda is making a movie about what a horrible thing it would be to bomb the Soviet Union like Failsafe, Jimmy Stewart is making a movie about how great it is to always be ready to bomb the Soviet Union. How do we get these doppelganger?
They're really fascinating. And I was invited by the Austrian Film Museum, my former workplace, to program a small show in December last year where Fonda and the Stewart film were connected to each other. And they were really best friends. They were best friends for 50 years. Stewart regularly visited Fonda on his sickbed in hospital, and they built model airplanes together in the desert, but not, you know, small, but really almost life-size model airplanes. They were struggling actors in the 30s together. And that refers back to your friend Larry and that he likes Eisenhower. That 50-year period, I think, was characterized by several things, but one being that diehard Democrats and diehard Republicans could have an actual civilized, friendly relationship for a long time. And Fonda and Stewart used to joke about that. They just said, well, we are friends, but we never talk politics because we would get into fights maybe. But they could openly discuss their different viewpoints. And they even made, it's not a very good film, which is why I chose at the end not to include it. But in 1970, Gene Kelly directed a Western called The Cheyenne Social Club. Which is the only film where Stewart and Fonda had both starring roles. They did appear in something else earlier, but there, the film and Gene Kelly, they play with the fact that these two cowboys, the film is set in the 19th century, have different opposing views. So it's almost like in Maud, they bring their real-life political convictions into the story of those two old Westerners. And that's what I meant with this referring to your Eisenhower thing. That was not a problem. The glue in society or the core was strong enough to withstand arguments or different viewpoints. It was accepted that at certain periods a majority of American electorate would vote for a Republican president, but as your friend Larry sees Eisenhower now, I guess worse things have happened in U.S. history than the two Eisenhower presidencies, even though it surely enabled the McCarthy program to be so relatively successful for a certain period. But I'm not sure if that could not have happened under a Truman the late Truman years are already full of this anti-communist rhetoric, and the studios, Jack Warner and the other studio heads, more or less agreeing to a blacklist. That happened, I think, before Eisenhower was inaugurated. So that's not so clear. Anyway, the Stewart-Fonda relationship is part of that. And while Stewart, as you have perfectly illustrated, chose roles, especially in the 50s and 60s, chose roles that would support maybe not a Goldwater type, but a clearly conservative agenda. Fonda in the 60s actually was mostly doing theater. He was really, he did these political films like Failsafe and The Best Man. So that made his viewpoint very clear. But otherwise, there is a lot of average or below average Fonda films in the 60s also. He was simply, he hoped to be a Broadway actor more or less and not do so much films anymore. But he followed the political climate, and those films, Advice and Consent, Best Man, The Best Man, and Failsafe represent that, of course. The FBI story that you mentioned, I think, is from 1957 already. Mm. And I had to think that the same year Fonda appears as the wrong man in Hitchcock, which is not a political film per se, but they are so different. You know, the justice system, the relation to guilt or non-guilt in The Wrong Man, and the FBI story. So you could you could make doubles like this, like I did. I wanted, actually, they didn't find a good print, I believe, but I wanted another double for this little series at the Film Museum, which is Daisy Kenyon and It's a Wonderful Life, both being immediate post-war reactions to the Second World War. Very different films, of course, Preminger and Capra being very different directors, but that's a nice double also. And as is Mr. Smith Goes to Washington and Young Mr. Lincoln and so on. You can follow these two. I do think, and I did ponder this question, are there maybe, I'm self-critical, maybe not as self-critical as Henry Fonda was, but I'm self-critical to a degree. So I asked myself, would Gary Cooper, would John Wayne, would James Stewart be equally rich subjects for an attempt to tell the story of America through the screen and the actual lives of a movie actor? And I came to the conclusion that it's neither of those would be as rich or would be as ambivalent and as interesting, and as, because also their biographies and back histories are different. So yes, Stewart comes to mind. I've been asked why Stewart doesn't have a more prominent role in my film. The only time he's mentioned is when Henry Fonda is surprised by Maud that she's planning this campaign for him to become US president, and he can't believe that she really means it. And he says, he turns to the camera and says, Jimmy Stewart put you up to this, right? As if it was a practical joke by his Republican friend, Jimmy Stewart. Otherwise, there would have been a way, of course, to include that too. But it, again, it would have been too much, I guess. There is a very moving moment at the American Film Institute salute for Henry Fonda, where Stewart speaks about his friend and also speaks about their political differences. But still, this all happened in a friendly and humane context, which is hardly imaginable today. You know, you cannot imagine, I don't know, Sylvester Stallone and George Clooney having a friendly, humane, and intelligent conversation about U.S. politics.
Yeah, that's right. I'm so struck. I'm so struck by how your work resonates with me, because I was talking this through with my wife, and those were the three I came up with, actually. Wayne, Cooper, and Stewart. And I mean, I would say before watching your film, I would have happily said that I preferred any of those three as actors. I mean, I've always liked Henry Fonda, but if you had said, who's your favorite classical Hollywood actor, those three are near the top for me. And, you know, we can talk about Cary Grant, obviously, et cetera, et cetera. You unlocked for me a new way of thinking about Fonda as an actor, which I wasn't expecting. But the other thing that seems to me so striking about this, I have too much to say, is, you know, I think I saw in something you wrote, maybe in the press kit, this concept. Here's another one of my anarchist talking points, is you use this concept of, I think you say, the acteur, which is to say, for those of people who are not cinephiles here, it's a long story. I went through it briefly in my episode on Preston Sturges, but the idea is essentially, you know, once upon a time, there was this person named the author, and they are the authority. That's where author comes from. And when they write a book, they write the book, and it's their book. So when J.K. Rowling comes out and says Dumbledore is gay because J.K. Rowling is the authority, end of story. And the earliest works of film criticism claimed, this is an oversimplification, but true, roughly, that films didn't have authors. They were a corporate thing, both in the sense of it was a large body that made them, and a corporate thing in the like vulgar Marxist sense of like what they represented was the view of Daryl F. Zanuck or one of the Warner Brothers or something like that. And then the intervention that I think is more or less right, and also an oversimplification, is Truffaut and Godard and a few others say, no, you know, sometimes maybe some movies are just rolling off the assembly line and there's no author to a Model T car the way there is an author to The Grapes of Wrath. But the director is the author, and we can say something about John Ford and who he is and what he has to say, in the same way that we can say something about William Shakespeare and who he is and what he has to say. And I shouldn't have said Shakespeare because that was also a corporate body and Shakespeare wrote most of his plays not alone. But anyways, that sort of thing. And I have, in fact, suggested that I teach classes based on actors before, kind of this actor theory. Mine, if I were to make this film, it would be about Stanwyck. And people just say, you can't teach a class about an actor. They're just sort of, you know, it'd be like teaching a class about a chair. You know, they're not an author. They're not an authority. Watching all of Fonda's films, or many of them, and then watching your documentary, made it very clear that Fonda was an actor. He had something to say. He had an authorial vision. It was very much about the justice system, more clear than anything else, how America knows it's doing the right thing and how it treats the people at the bottom, the people who have been discriminated against, and above all, the people who are subject to police power. And then in both interviews that you played and in interviews I've seen with Dick Cavett and everything, people say, you know, so Hank, tell us about how you feel about the justice system. And he says, I don't know. I just played the parts, you know? So he's both destabilizing the director as God, and also destabilizing his own authority, even as you're able to see that he has an authorial position. Okay, also not a question, but again, please respond.
No, but I was fascinated by this tension between my own view, which is similar, I assume, as yours, that there are certain actors, and it's really important to say certain actors whose body of work reaches a certain consistency. Stanwyck would be one. Isabelle Huppert is another. Peter Lorre is a fourth one, and so on. Whom you could ascribe, and you should ascribe, a co-authorial role, quasi-authorial role. Not the only author, of course, but I do think that the Model T, the comparison of movies to industrial product is also not completely wrong, of course.
Sure. Yes.
The commercial movie system has these two sides. It is the product of many people and many systematic layers in the industry, and it is also the product of individuals and the auteur theory that the French critics first developed. André Bazin, very importantly, said that in this system, there are these individual authors, and they meant the directors, which is all fine. And I'm more or less still an auteurist. I would, if you tell me there is a Wellman film on show at this movie house that I have not seen, I will go because it is a Wellman film. Mm-hmm. At the same time, having been a big fan and having also done retrospectives on pre-code cinema, where Wellman and others, lesser known names like Roy Del Ruth, played a very prominent role, I'm also aware of the immense importance of people like James Cagney and Joan Blondell and Barbara Stanwyck and so on. So even the William Wellman cinema is also the James Cagney cinema. So I've more and more come to the conclusion that with auteurism alone, we don't really reach the potential that this strange art form, which exists between the assembly line and the individual, you know, poets scribbling, it's somewhere in between. Sometimes in avant-garde cinema, which I love, it's very close to the poet scribbling the lines or the composer thinking of something. In other cases, which I equally love, it's the product, like Grapes of Wrath is not only a product of John Ford. Steinbeck cannot be taken out of the equation, and neither can Zanuck, and neither can Fonda, whose intense wish and hope to play this role of Tom Joad made him a victim of Zanuck's blackmailing, because Zanuck said, well, you can play Tom Joad only if you sign a 7-year contract with 20th Century Fox. And Fonda accepted, and he hated the fact that he had to play several roles which he believed were of lower importance or bad movies. So this constellation shift, and we should see Ford as an auteur, and I believe we should see Fonda as a co-auteur, as important as screenwriters like Lamar Trotti were for Ford and others. And I once in my film museum years in Vienna, in 2008 or 2009, I did a show called Acteur Auteur. So it dealt with exactly this issue. And to return to my beginning, I love the tension between my and Fonda's view of this issue, because I knew I wanted to go in that direction and show him as a co-author of an oeuvre, of a real oeuvre. And I knew how he always responded in interviews and talk shows to this. And that's why I loved the DeKavitt excerpts that we found, where Fonda says, well, as you already explained, he liked to see himself as a puppet in the hands of real authors. You know, he saw himself as almost as a zero. He thought his only talent is acting. He knew he was a good actor, but otherwise he believed, and this becomes clear in many of the excerpts that we use in the film, that he had nothing to say. He has no good answers to anything, which is the final sentence that he speaks in the film. And he was super self-critical, skeptical of his own ability. And I'm not sure if this was coquettish or if it was that deep down inside, he knew that he wanted to and was able to, at least partly, express certain convictions and worldviews through his acting. But since he never wrote a script and he only produced one film, 12 Angry Men, he must have felt in that era that it's preposterous to turn up on talk shows and speak about himself as if he were an author. Maybe he knew deep down inside that there is a kind of authorship through performance. And that's very important to me. It's not only the worldviews and the convictions and the issues in American life that his important films deal with. It's also a certain style. And that's part of what the French theorists and critics said about directors as auteurs, as authors. It's not only the worldview, it's also the way they set up the camera, the way they shoot films, the way they shoot actors, and so on. So it's also a matter of craft. And Fonda's craft as a performer is an essential part of this authorship. There is a through line from the 30s to his last film in which his type of very, how should I say, shy or inward, the sort of inwards acting that he repeatedly does, that's part of his authorship. So this author, if we want to call him that, consists both of a certain content, you could say, certain issues, certain views, certain convictions, and on the other hand, of certain stylistic means. And we are smart if we look at cinema as a art form that exists not only in language, even though we spend so many words on it now and always. Performance is its own language, like music is a language, you could say, quotation marks at least. There is, everybody accepts that there are musical authors, even in the, not songwriters, but Schubert, you know. Composers are seen as authors in a certain sense. They are the sole representative of that oeuvre that goes by the name of Schubert's works. So performers should have the equal opportunity to develop such authorial voices through their art of performing. And that's what I wanted to also make visible a little bit in the film, that it's not just the political positions, the social positions, but also his as a man, as a body, as a being who is in front of a camera, in front of an audience. How do you behave in that role? So yeah, that's
that's perfect. And just to stretch it further, at least every film that isn't animated is also a documentary film, which is to say it is documenting something. And certainly many of Fonda's films can also be considered essay films in the way, not essay films in the, you know, colloquial sense that essay means they're making an argument, although they're often making an argument, but in their terms, they're making an argument that they're reaching for, that they're trying out. And it seems that as a performer and a self-effacing performer, he's almost a film essayist in a way that I think Jimmy Stewart is not, and John Wayne is not, and Gary Cooper is maybe only with Capra or something like that, but otherwise is not a film essayist either.
I would absolutely agree. And what comes to mind now is a line that, because it also highlights stuff that we spoke about before, his autobiographer, this writer, Howard Teichman, to whom Fonda more or less dictated his autobiography in 1980-81, called him, after they had spent months together, he called Fonda a closet intellectual. Maybe that's a good way of describing this, what I tried to describe before, that he publicly would distance himself from all these notions of him being an intellectual or etc. But Teichman had the same feeling, that this guy thinks a lot about things. He's reflective, he's skeptical, but he tries to express it not by appearing on Dick Cavett and saying, I think this should be done and this and that. He does it through performing. And that's a very indirect and very hard to nail down way of expressing a person expressing their views on life, you know. And he did it, I believe, because he understood the language of performance.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. Okay, I want to mention a few films and moments, and then I'm going to give you the last word. So first, listeners, if you have not seen this film, The Grapes of Wrath, it is as good a film as has ever been made. If you look into the director at all, a man named John Ford, people will tell you he's a right winger. This is totally not true. John Ford was politically incoherent by any attempt to put John Ford into any sort of ideology of the kind that you would like to have when you're trying to vote for someone. John Ford doesn't have that. Grapes of Wrath is a socialist book. It is a socialist film. It's also a John Ford film. It's also a Western. And just watch it. That's the first thing. The second thing is, the American political system really doesn't have any anarchy baked into its rules and laws. The anarchy is always there under the surface, as you listen. Anyone who listens to this podcast knows. There is one place, though, that I think is just definitionally anarchy, which is, you know, if anarchy is non-hierarchical consensus, then when we get 12 jurors together, and actually, I have jury duty for the first time in my life tomorrow as we are recording. Wow. And the other Henry Fonda film that I was shown as a civics film is, as you say, the only film that he claimed some authorship for. It's called 12 Angry Men, and it is a movie about a jury, which is to say a non-hierarchical, consensus-based attempt. It's not a movie where Fonda is being railroaded by the justice system, of which he made a few, nor is it one where he's a witness to the justice system, injustice system. That was my wife's joke all the way through. She said, Henry Fonda doesn't know anything about the justice system. It's only an injustice system, which that sounds good. But it is it's when it gets anarchic in 12 Angry Men, when there's no authority, it's just 12 men, 12 people, but 12 men in a room talking, the outcome is different. So I'll stop there and say see if there's anything you want to say about 12 Angry Men.
It's one of his most famous films. Both of these films are almost signature films for Fonda, and that to a certain degree, I wanted always, even as a teenager, I was surprised and interested in Fonda reading that these two films are his signature films. How far beyond those, because he's the slightly boring image that sometimes attaches to Fonda, the good liberal, is often explained with these two films, even though when you watch them, it can't be explained by those two films, because in Grapes of Wrath, he's a murderer, he's back from prison, he's aggressive, he's not the good liberal at all. Nevertheless, in our culture, and already in the 80s and 90s, when I mentioned the name Henry Fonda, people always said, the good liberal. So in that sense, my film, and in general, I'm trying to show the richness of his roles, you know, that he, for the Apache, he plays a very uptight colonel, and there are so many shades to his screen lives that, in essence, I feel more drawn toward the films that are not in everybody's mind, like Daisy Canyon, the post-war film by Preminger, or his screwball comedy roles, not only The Lady Eve, which is very well known, but also The Moons Are Home. And there are some lovely comedies that I couldn't even all get into the film, where he shows that as a dope, he also is very strong. You know, he can play the rural dope really well. And not only the millionaire dope, as in The Lady Eve. Nevertheless, I agree with you that Grapes of Wrath and 12 Angry Men allow us to get at certain core things of Fonda. The funny thing is that 12 Angry Men, I was in upstate New York with a friend, and Eve Heller, a wonderful experimental filmmaker, and her sister gave me a book, a biography of Sidney Lumet. And I read the chapter on 12 Angry Men, and I realized that it was not a hit at all. It was deemed as a failure commercially. As a failure, United Artists would have loved to continue with Fonda and Lumet, and Fonda producing further films. I'm happy that they did get back together again for Failsafe 7 years later, but since it was commercially not so successful, that idea stopped dead in his tracks, I guess. But it turned into one of the most loved films in American cinema. It became an absolutely iconic film, and my students, you know, if I have this, I'm sorry for digressing again, but I had this strange experience a year ago or so, when I showed Fritz Lang's M to two students. And these were just bachelor film students, I should say, but nevertheless, they were pretty bored by the film, or they told me that this was a small group of three people, three male students, saying, I could not get into that, it's so slow, and I hate watching black and white films anyway, and that kind of talk, which probably some of your students, you get that too. Hopefully not, but maybe you do. So I always feel pretty downtrodden in such moments. But I asked the guys, so what's an old film, old black and white film, that does not do that to you, that engages you, that thrills you? And they said 12 Angry Men. And I felt, of course, happy, because they named the Fonda film. And I tried to understand. And that told me, okay, what I read in this Lumet biography, it's really true. Generation after generation after generation, the very young finding their path to older films will find that film very quickly, and it will still function not only as a civics lesson, but as an incredibly tight chamber play with 12 fantastic actors, and with Fonda's role as the individual who can turn the tide when things are seemingly obvious and the outcome is seemingly there on the table, Fonda's skepticism or his attempt to go behind that first reaction turned the tide over those 90 minutes. So I must admit, I've come to that conclusion myself only. I loved the film when I saw it as a teenager. Later on, I thought, genre films and westerns, and it's all much more interesting than those issue-oriented films. Mm. But now I'm in my 50s, I've realized that it is actually one of the great American films. And it was a teleplay that also helps you to understand that the confrontation of television and cinema that was so strong over certain periods is not, and it's not the right answer, because some of the great movies of the 50s and 60s have direct relationships to television history. And Lumet already directed a teleplay a few years earlier of that same exact play by Reginald Rose. And because Fonda loved the subject, he wanted to give it a wider presence in American culture, in American life, and said, I will produce this. This has to become a movie. And it did. It was not successful, but turned out to be this almost myth or this icon. So it's things go like that. Then maybe we're back to Hegel and the ruses of history. The way today films are being perceived as in terms of how their first weekend at the box office makes, and if they will stay with us or not, depending on how much money they've made in their first week or so, is just silly, because culture works differently. And 12 Angry Men is a good example of that too, I guess.
Yeah, no, that's excellent. I sort of had that same journey. The first time I saw 12 Angry Men, I was like, yeah, it's kind of boring. I was watching a lot of Scorsese at the time, and it just, you know, I wasn't interested in 12 Angry Men. The last thing I need to mention is that I almost jumped out of my chair watching the film when another one of the screwball comedies, and I must say not a very good one, called The Male Animal, which I haven't seen because it's, you know, supposedly a not, or I had not seen. And I was shocked to see right in the middle of your film that there is a Henry Fonda movie in which Henry Fonda takes a stand for the right to teach a speech by an anarchist in the college classroom.
I actually thought that our conversation would deal with Sacco and Vanzetti, but you have reached it at the end, I guess.
Well, I couldn't leave it alone, but I didn't want, you know, we don't need to, I actually haven't done an episode on Sacco and Vanzetti. I touched Haymarket recently, but I mean, Sacco and Vanzetti, they were anarchists. They were killed by the injustice system. I believe the consensus of history now is Sacco did it and Vanzetti didn't. But no, I don't give a fuck about that. The point is, neither of them could be proved to have committed this murder. They were killed for being anarchists, it was 40 years after the Haymarket martyrs were killed, essentially. Someone was killed. People were killed. They were probably killed by anarchists. We're not sure. And the police were happy to just kill some local anarchists, which is wrong, which is unjust. It was an international outcry. And this film, The Male Animal, which I had never seen and barely heard of, is he's a composition professor, which is mostly what I teach. He's teaching writing. Mm-hmm. And he just says, you know, I've got this really interesting piece of writing. It just happens to be by an anarchist. And the great bull-voiced actor, he plays the Pikes Pale...
Eugene Paillette, you mean?
Or? Eugene Paillette, yes, who is just... He plays tycoons. He's one of the actors who's called on to play tycoons. And he plays a football-minded tycoon who doesn't want to have anarchists in his classroom. And Alex, you don't know this, but there is an American football coach named Bill Belichick who's considered the greatest football coach of all time. And he recently joined the University of North Carolina in a enormous coup for whoever the tycoons are who are running our university. So I was watching this movie. I'm an anarchist professor without tenure at UNC about this collision between football tycoons and a professor who wants to read anarchists in the classroom. And what I thought was simply going to be an essay film about Fonda in America, which is obviously, as anyone who's made it through 90 minutes of this talk knows, is about as important to me as something can be, suddenly became just directly on the nose about my life. And so if nothing else, just thank you for bringing The Male Animal to my attention.
Well, I'm happy that I did. And I must say, I would defend that film. It's not stylistically important or great, but it is an actually a rich subject that this film deals with, namely Americanism. It shot before Pearl Harbor, came out after, in early 1942. And Eugene Pallette, who at first seems like the extreme right winger, very conservative, found playing this liberal professor. At the end, Eugene Pallette marches with all the liberals who have fought for the freedom of speech and freedom to teach. And anyone who does not join in this triumphant walk, are you a fascist? Eugene Pallette asks them. So he's turned into an anti-fascist at the end, which is, I mean, you could go into so many directions in American life around 1941, 42, if you look at that film. And Fonda has some extremely comic and humorous parts in when he's drunk and speaks about penguins and tigers and so on. It's just, I love discovering that film, I must say, and that I'm happy I was able to include at least those reading of Sacco and Vanzetti that he finally does, because he stands up for the freedom to teach anarchist writings or a letter from an anarchist, just as he teaches everything else in English literature.
Okay. Yes. I mean, I actually deeply admired the film, the hour or so of the film that was about, those issues. I admired the part, the screwball romance of the film and the subplot, especially with, anyways, I don't need to go into that. I thought that was weaker. Yeah, it was no.
I agree.
And then, you know, okay. So finally, again, wheeling this back away to Stanley Cavell. So Stanley Cavell, you know, says these Hollywood comedies in which a husband and a wife come apart and then come back together because they have in some way learned, reconciled, overcome, changed. And he identifies, I think, seven. We can certainly add a few to that. But in fact, there's hundreds of these films in which they come apart and come back together, but almost always they come back together for no real clear reason. The script demands it. There's some sort of hijinks. Cavell says, for it to really count for him, there has to be this moment where the characters reach and reconcile, truly reconcile, not just, oh, well, you know, we're married and I find you sexually attractive, or we would lose the house or whatever. And that's, The Male Animal is one of those films that does not have a moment of true reconciliation. The reconciliation just gets carried along by the plot. So it fails the Cavell test.
I do agree, but your reference to Cavell now brings me to the notion, which is maybe childish, but if the rifts and abysses in American life now could be healed, is a much too pathetic word, I guess, but if there was a comedy of remarriage, to use that metaphor of Cavell's for these romantic comedies, if there was a comedy of remarriage where American politics and life and society could remarry the way they were in that central part of the 20th century, that would be a lovely future that I hope I will live to see.
Yeah, I hope so too. I mean, I would love to start with a remarriage of the left liberals and the socialists. And as you know, one of my guests was telling me, I just sounded so much more hopeful during the Biden years. You know, Cory Doctorow says, you know, basically that the Biden White House was, you know, half Hillary Clinton, Kamala people and half Bernie AOC people. And he was pretty scathing about the Hillary Kamala half, which I'm sure I would have been as well. But I would also say, I mean, would I have preferred a White House of 100% Bernie people? Sure. But I viewed the Biden White House as a marriage of the left and the center left. And yeah. I started predicting 30 glorious years. So history makes fools of us all.
Yeah.
Alexander Horvath, director of the film Henry Fonda for President, I cannot believe how much time you've given me. More importantly, I can't believe the gift of this film you have given me. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Graham. I hope it's been interesting for listeners to listen to us. I I genuinely enjoyed our conversation. Thank you for making contact.
All right. It was such a pleasure. Thank you, Alex.